This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Young people see Museveni as the face of an out-of-touch dictator, unable to meet the needs of the country's massive unemployed workforce. It is stuck in a downward spiral of declining governance, poor economic management, and increasing local insecurity.
That was Pat Thaker, editorial director of Middle East and Africa at the Economist Intelligence Unit on Uganda's controversial election. Details coming up also. President Cyril Ramaphosa says millions of migrants living in South Africa will not be excluded from COVID-19 vaccinations. And a UN report finds an alarming surge in human rights violations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Delegates from Libya's opposing sides kicked off a five-day meeting yesterday to choose an interim prime minister and a three-person presidency council in a bid to reunite Libya before an election on December 24th. 24 candidates are running for the new presidential council, while 21 seeking to become the interim prime minister. Last week, the Biden administration urged Russia, Turkey, and the UAE to halt their military intervention in Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shinawi spoke with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and president of Libya Analysis, about whether these developments could lead to a genuine political solution in Libya.
Well, one would hope so, but all history and reason tells us that it would not. This process that we're seeing play out in Geneva and Tunis is the Libyan political dialogue process. It's the latest in a round of many UN-sponsored and UN-mediated dialogues. All this process seeks to do is to create another transitional authority, which would then have the power to oversee elections. I don't think that's sufficient, because a political solution for it to last would need to have a constitution and would need to be based on a fundamental redoing of the Libyan economy. And none of those things will happen, even if this process does successfully culminate in an interim prime minister and a reform presidency council, which it may not do.
21 candidates are running for prime minister, including Fathi Bashagha, the powerful interior minister in Tripoli, and Ahmed Maytek, a deputy prime minister of the UN-recognized government in Tripoli. While 24 candidates are running for the presidential council posts. Those include Aqila Saleh, speaker of the based House of Representatives, and Khaled Al-Mishri, the head of Tripoli-based government Supreme Council of State. Would a power sharing succeed in Libya?
It's fascinating that you frame what's going on in terms of the idea of power sharing, because I think that that cuts to the heart of the matter, which is that the UN only knows one approach. And that approach is power sharing. It looks at all civil wars, be it in Nigeria or Yemen or Syria or Libya, as the same. Oh, there are two sides. To make peace, let's take some people from side A, some people from side B, and have them share power. That's not what's going on in Libya. And therefore, this attempt to have all these establishment figures from East and West share power makes no sense. It's exactly the same error that was used in the Skhirat agreement in 2015 and led to the current GNA government, which is now also not representative. So yes, I'm so disappointed to see all these institutional players being put forward as names and nominees for some kind of power sharing agreement, which is bound to fail.
The United States called on Russia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates to halt their military intervention in Libya. Would these foreign countries exert their sway on the election choices too?
This is a very good question, because one of the few positives on Libya that has happened in the last weeks is that the new Biden administration has signaled in no uncertain terms to the spoiler powers, i.e. Russia, Turkey, and the UAE, that their interventions are not welcome anymore, and that they will be hurt and attacked by the U.S. in some kind of way if they destabilize the UN process. That said, despite this clear signaling through the UN of the Biden administration's change in position on the Trump policies, we are already seeing alternative processes to the UN process being put forward by Russia. And the Russians are having people like Ahmed Maitig to Moscow and others, and maybe there's even talk of a Haftar-Sarraj deal behind the scenes that would present an alternative process to the UN process. In short, everything is still undecided. And just as the UN is trying to make progress, these other players like Russia, the UAE, and Turkey are trying to create their own alternatives.
That was Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and president of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Yoweri Museveni has been elected to a sixth consecutive term as Ugandan president, but opposition members and international observers are raising questions about whether the election was free and fair. VOA Salem Salamon has this report.
The voting is over in Uganda's presidential election, but the fallout from the hotly contested event is still shaking the nation. The National Electoral Commission declared President Yoweri Museveni the winner with 58% of the vote on January 16. But opposition candidate Bobi Wine says the vote was marred by harassment of his supporters and ballot stuffing.
These and many other irregularities and fraudulent actions, for which we have overwhelming evidence, prove one thing. This has been the most fraudulent election in the history of Uganda.
Following the election, Wine was confined to his home as the military and police surrounded it for 11 days. Wine and his supporters have vowed to challenge the results in court.
We call upon the people of Uganda to reject this mockery and to refuse to acknowledge Museveni as the winner of the 14th January polls. We defeated Museveni, and we were supposed to be announced as winners.
The 76-year-old former rebel leader Museveni lauded the 57% of Uganda's 18 million registered voters who participated in the election. He declared it free and fair.
I therefore thank the people of Uganda, and I congratulate you for turning up in big numbers and voting for the candidates and for the parties of your choice. I think this may turn out to be the most cheating-free election since 1962.
Many international observers disagree. Both the U.S. and the European Union canceled plans to send observers to monitor the election, citing a lack of access and the threat of electoral violence. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey said he plans to work with the administration of President Joe Biden to respond and hold Uganda accountable for irregularities, and vowed there will be consequences for those that repeatedly engage in the willful subversion of democracy. Pat Thanker of the Economist Intelligence Unit said Museveni's government went to great lengths to silence the opposition, and that is evidence that they believe Wine presents a serious threat to his rule.
In fact, you could say he turned the lopsided political environment on its head, and he's actually started something that cannot be reversed. He's opened a Pandora's box that needed to be opened.
But Museveni's supporters say the country's economy has improved under his leadership, and the president has prioritized infrastructural progress.
Expectation from President Museveni, first of all, is security. Has done a good. The second of it is going to finish up the roads which has been constructing, the hospitals, education, is going to do more. What I'm expecting to him.
Uganda is one of the youngest countries in the world, with a median age of 16, but more than half of the young people of working age are unemployed. Observers see this as a volatile combination.
Young people see Museveni as the face of an out-of-touch dictator, unable to meet the needs of the country's massive unemployed workforce. It is stuck in a downward spiral of declining governance, poor economic management, and increasing local insecurity.
Thangar believes Museveni and his advisors are well aware of youth unrest, which is why the country ordered an internet shutdown for approximately 100 hours before and after the election.
Government's recent actions, shutting down the internet, the very aggressive, harsh response to protests, any opposition, any voice of an opposition in any form, media shutdown, lockdown of social media, television, radio, they actually laid the groundwork for future civil conflict.
Meanwhile, the opposition's whine vows to press the cause in the international arena while calling on Ugandans to continue to protest the election results. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says millions of migrants living in South Africa will not be excluded from COVID-19 vaccinations even if they lack the legal documents to be there. In a speech after receiving the country's first batch of 1 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, Ramaphosa also announced lockdown restrictions are being relaxed, saying there was evidence the second wave is easing. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Ramaphosa's announcement yesterday left many migrants breathing a sigh of relief following earlier rumors that they would be excluded from the government-led vaccination program.
We aim to make the vaccine available to all adults living in South Africa, regardless of their citizenship or resident status. We will be putting in place measures to deal with the challenge of undocumented migrants in our country so that we can properly record and track their vaccination history.
He said the country is on course to get enough vaccine to inoculate 40 million residents by the end of the year. A second batch of 500,000 doses is expected to arrive before the end of the month. The country has ordered an additional 12 million doses through the global COVAX facility, 9 million doses from Johnson & Johnson, and Pfizer has committed to deliver 20 million doses. Foreign nationals welcomed the announcement. Ngabuto Mabena is the chairperson of a non-governmental organization calling itself the Zimbabwe Community in South Africa.
It shows the pan-Africanist character of the African National Congress and the government that is leading. And you also isolate the reactionaries in this country who call themselves by the name People First, who have been advocating that migrants should not benefit from this vaccine.
Ramaphosa also announced lockdown restrictions being eased, with curfew hours shortened and a ban on alcohol sales and distribution lifted. Beaches and parks are among the public places that have reopened, bringing great relief to the tourism sector that was on the verge of collapse. Chifiwa Chivengwa is the CEO of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa.
It's been a tough past 2 months. But I do think now we can go back, we can start working. I think the most important thing is that we should avoid returning to this type of restrictions because they're not helpful in terms of having the industry being open and closed. For us, you know, you need lead time in order for tourists to book, to pay, and for them to travel. It's not something that just happened overnight.
Vaccination is expected to start in 2 weeks for frontline workers, people with pre-existing conditions, and the elderly before spreading to the entire population. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A UN report finds an alarming surge in human rights violations against civilians in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri and North Kivu provinces. It blames the surge on increased attacks by an armed group, the Allied Democratic Forces. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Allied Democratic Forces originated as a Ugandan rebel group in the 1990s, but has been active mainly in eastern Congo in recent years. The new report accuses ADF members of deliberately targeting civilian populations, of sexual abuse, and of abducting hundreds of civilians to perform forced labor. The UN Joint Human Rights Office in the DRC says last year the group killed at least 849 civilians in Irumu and Mombasa territory in Ituri province, as well as in Beni in North Kivu. UN Human Rights Monitors report the ADF also kidnapped 534 civilians, of whom 457 are still missing. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says violence has continued into this year. In one attack on January 13th, she says unknown armed men killed at least 14 people, including two pregnant women.
Given the widespread and systematic nature of the attack directed against the civilian population, some of the documented human rights abuses may amount to crimes against humanity. The violence takes place in a context of impunity, where few human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law are duly investigated and prosecuted.
The report also accuses government security and defense forces of human rights violations committed while fighting members of the ADF. Hurtado says the report documents numerous atrocities by DRC security forces.
According to the report, from July to December 2020, 25 civilians were killed. 18 women and 10 children were sexually abused, and 45 arbitrarily arrested by the security forces. From January to June, 22 civilians were killed, 9 women and 2 children were sexually abused, and 81 were arbitrarily arrested at the hands of security forces.
The UN office is calling on the DRC authorities to keep their security forces in line and make sure they behave in accordance with international humanitarian law. It also urges the government to investigate crimes, bring the perpetrators to justice, and provide humanitarian aid for survivors, including those displaced by the violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Democratic Republic of Congo's president Felix Tshisekedi has formed a new political alliance known as the Sacred Union following the removal of Prime Minister Sylvester Ilunga Ilunkamba. However, political analysts say he will find it difficult to juggle the diverging interests of his coalition made up of 20 groups, further raising political tension in the country. For more, VOA's Chinedu O4 reached Dr. Noel Siani, former presidential candidate and leader of the Force of Change political group.
That President Tshisekedi is taking the control of the institution because it was very clear that President Kabila did not show goodwill in the sense that he was blocking his successor from taking control of the institution and managing the country the way it should be. Every single decision that President Tshisekedi had to take, he had to go and negotiate with President Kabila, who did not even want to move forward, who blocked almost every single thing. So the majority of the Congolese people are happy today that President Tshisekedi has freed himself from that control that he was under from President Kabila. And therefore, we do hope that in the future, the government, which is going to be put in place, will be a government accountable to the president and will be implementing the president's vision so that the people of the Congo can benefit from the natural resources of the country.
What about the influence of the former president who ruled DRC for so many years? Are you saying his influence is on the decline?
His influence has diminished very substantially. Remember that he had the control of the National Assembly. He claimed to control the National Assembly, but when the National Assembly was put to a test, the president of the National Assembly, who came from Kabila's side, was dismissed. Now the prime minister, who came from Kabila's side, was dismissed, which means that the influence that President Kabila hoped to have had on the government institution was just fictitious. The majority he had in parliament was fictitious because when they asked every single parliamentarian to choose his camp, it looks like the majority of the parliamentarians have chosen to be with President Tshisekedi than with President Kabila. So I believe that Kabila has lost control of this institution and Tshisekedi is now in charge.
What are the chances that these two men will work together peacefully instead of what people are terming a messy political divorce?
Well, you know that President Kabila has led this country, has governed this country over 18 years. And what result has he achieved? Today, Congo, despite the abundance of natural resources, is one of the poorest countries in the world, which means that Kabila did not manage the country properly. The unemployment rate is about 85% of the active population. You find less than 10% of the population having access to water and electricity, and many people are dying of hunger in a country which is capable of producing enough food to feed the whole of Africa, which means that President Kabila had failed as a president.
Supporters of former President Kabila say that he did his best, at least he organized an election that led to President Tshisekedi taking power. Is that not an achievement on its own?
No, in reality, President Kabila did not organize the election because he wanted to hand over to somebody else. The election was bloody. Before having the election, he tried to change the constitution. He tried to change the electoral laws. There were many people killed on the street. I can mention a few people like Rosie Chimanga, like Therese Kapangala. There were many people, militant of UGPS, Tshisekedi's political party, were killed, burnt to death. So Kabila did not organize the election because he wanted to hand power to someone. He organized the election under pressure from the national authorities, from the population, and from the international community. Remember also that the international community helped a lot by sending some of the people who were working with Kabila, the Boshab, the Lambert Mende. So I do not believe that Kabila is to be credited for having organized a free and fair election because he wanted to.
That's Dr. Noel Siani, former presidential candidate and leader of the Force of Change political group, speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Kinshasa. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the internet.